Legal Matters.
15 minutes after 8 o'clock, Itumeleng Masoleng on Twitter says he likes the idea of the Mkosi Hour. Back in the day, there was a magazine called Pace Magazine. That many people, Chris, when are you? You know Pace? Oh, you don't know Pace. You know Pace? When? Yeah, no, that's nice. There was a magazine called Pace Magazine back in the day. And there was a Mkosi Corner there. So maybe we steal some of those ideas and we put them into the Mkosi Hour in the final hour of the show. Claire Thompson is here with me, specialist family law practitioner and head of the law or family law department at WITS Incorporated. Claire, good evening to you and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Aubrey. Nice to be with you again.
Always, always wonderful to have you on the show. Spousal, or is it? Can you say that? Is spousal only for people that are married? That term is
yes.
Only for
spouse.
People, right?
Yes.
Spouse. You are married, or spouse signifies the union of marriage.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, in law. Yes, right. Absolutely.
The reason why I gravitate to that word is because we've always thought of spousal maintenance, right? Even after marriage breaks, we still think of spousal marriage. What do you call it when there is a claim for maintenance by people who were never married in the traditional sense?
Exactly that, a claim for maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a nice word to sort of pin our hat to. And I think when we think about American law, for example, we use the word alimony because we've seen this on TV. I've even seen it on a number plate once of a very expensive car. Somebody's obviously got a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Spousal maintenance probably doesn't look quite as good on a number plate, but in the context of a romantic relationship, it's just a claim for maintenance. So, and the question really is can somebody claim maintenance if they haven't been married? Because in law, there is this concept of spousal maintenance. There is legislation that supports it. There are all sorts of court processes that support it. There's a Rule 43, and it's contained in a main divorce action as well.
But that's spousal maintenance.
Yes.
Right? In the many conversations that I've had with you about various family law issues, one thing that has come out of those conversations for me is the fact that the law is a suggestion. I'm looking at Claire's face when I say that as a lawyer. She's like, what? No. Bear with me. It is becoming more and more apparent to me that you can argue almost anything in law and actually get your way in a court of law if you've got a cogent argument that is to be found in law.
Absolutely.
I'm not suggesting a Machiavellian sort of approach to law where we do whatever we want. I don't think that that's right for any social order. But I'm beginning to realize that there is no holy cow in law. You can argue anything, quite frankly, right?
Yes, if it falls within a particular boundary, and those boundaries are often the things that we're taught in law school and that seem, I think, quite elusive to people who haven't studied law. And I think very often the criticism of lawyers is, how can we, for example, take on this client's case? But what we are really taught to do is possibly work on either side. I've said to you before, I can work for the husband today and I can work for the wife tomorrow, and I can sit on totally opposing sides of the coin and I can argue both matters successfully. And I think I say this often, I think this is the reason why lawyers are going to be in business for a very long time, is because we come at the law and the facts that a client presents to us with an interpretation that we then believe should be argued before the court. And we look for the reasons to justify what it is that we want to put forward to the court. And then we go and argue it. And we ask the court to make a judgment. And in this case, where we have a legal framework that says, if you opt into marriage, you enjoy the benefits. What are those benefits? Spousal maintenance. If you don't opt into marriage, then why should you enjoy those benefits? But when we look at that scenario, when you have somebody who is dependent on their partner, not their spouse, on their partner, they have been for a very long time, they've enjoyed a certain lifestyle together, maybe they've had children together, like you've said, maybe the one person isn't working and is wholly dependent on the other. We then go to court to ask the court to come to our client's aid and say, but really, should we not develop the law in such a way that it allows this person to be more supported by the law, to enjoy the benefits that somebody who we ordinarily call a spouse would ordinarily enjoy, but for the fact that she wasn't married, she can't enjoy these. And so we go to court and we argue this. And of course, the party on the other side objects to our reasoning. And the court ultimately is tasked with deciding between the two versions which one it can justify in law.
So I want to make a distinction then in the way that I asked the question about the pre-revelation of the idea that the law is a suggestion in the way that you've just explained now, which the question would be a very simple one, but it wouldn't be a fair one, because the question would say, so what does the law say about non-spousal maintenance, right? Because that would suggest that there is a finishing clearness about that matter. And you've just basically explained to me that, no, there is no such thing as finishing clear. There is no such thing as the law says finishing clear. If you've got an interpretation, an argument that can be presented to a court of law, you have, therefore, then the chance to actually have the court grant your prayer, even though there is no precedent. If the argument is cogent, if I'm understanding you correctly, if it falls within the particular boundaries of whatever legislation is there, even though there is no precedent, you're suggesting to me that there can be a new precedent?
So I think what's important to distinguish is that there is legislation that is a set of rules that the government creates, and that legislation must be interpreted by the court. It's not for the court to make law.
Okay.
This is what separation of powers is. This is what we call separation of powers in law. However, sometimes legislation is created that doesn't accord with the Constitution. And that's where you'll see that there are constitutional court challenges, or constitutional challenges rather, by attorneys or advocates or legal representatives to the court to say, the way that this legislation has been drafted is inconsistent with the Constitution and it should either be sent back to the legislature or struck down or whatever the case may be. On the other hand, there is the common law. And the common law is what we get from our Roman, Dutch, and English heritage that has been developed over time, supplemented by African customary law developed in the Constitution, well, in the constitutional era, and isn't codified. There isn't a set of written down rules that the legislature has debated and created. And it's that law that the courts are tasked with interpreting and developing in line with the laws and morals of society. And I think what's particularly interesting about that is that the way society changes very often is what guides the development of that that common law. Because what was good for our parents and their parents before them is very different from what our society presents now. And just what you've said to, just what you referenced earlier about your next guest, the concept of Ben 10s of women dating younger men. It's a reflection, I think, of the change of society. That might seem like a small aspect of it, but the small things, I think, sometimes in life often represent big changes in law.
Of course they do. So give us a call as Claire and I wade through some of these legal principles. So how do I ask the question about both the common law and legislation as it pertains to non-spousal maintenance? Can somebody who is not married, who did not commit to the marital vow, as it were, when that relationship, for whatever reason, ends, ask the law for maintenance from the boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever the story might be? Can they do that?
Absolutely. This is exactly what we see in this case of EW that was recently heard by the Western Cape High Court. And they were tasked with determining in this case whether the woman in a heterosexual relationship...
I can see all them Cholo people standing up now. All right, guys. Some Cholo just got real, folks. Yeah, you heard that? Cholo has just gotten real. Okay, so yes is the answer. All right, so tell me more.
So your question was, can you go to court? My answer is yes. In this case, the applicant, the woman, wasn't successful. There was a full bench decision, three judges. There are two judges, which is the majority judgment, and there's one judge that dissents.
That was such a lawyer answer, Claire. You can go to court, but you might not be successful. Okay. So what that means is that you can go to court. I think that's a very important principle to establish. So whether you are just jolling, even married, the option to go to court is always open to you, is what you're saying to me.
The option to go to court is open, but I think the court importantly makes the distinction, I think, between jawling and the concept of a permanent life partnership where people have an obligation to one another of maintenance. And in a relationship, just like in a marriage, the way that people maintain one another, as we've discussed before, is either in money or in shared services towards the relationship, supporting one another, supporting their children, and things like that.
Right.
And so in this particular case, it was a 9-year relationship. Three children were born of the relationship. The woman had stopped working. She was wholly dependent on the man. And when the relationship broke down, he slowly but surely started to whittle down the maintenance that would have been paid to her. So he still maintained the children. But the question was, what about her? Because the children's maintenance is an entirely different discussion that's dealt with by the maintenance court. But what
is
about
the Children's
her?
Act as far as that
yes,
is concerned?
Yes, sure. and the Maintenance Act. So we don't really need to deal with the children in this instance.
Yeah.
But what about her? She hadn't been working for I think, about 7-8 years at the time of the relationship breaking down. And I think, you know, we can look online and to see the impact that stopping work very often can have on a person in a relationship that steps out of the role of the workplace and steps into the role of looking after the family. There's a very marked decrease in one's earning capacity.
I imagine that the principle cuts both ways, right? So if it had been the boyfriend of 9 years going to the courts, whether he wins or loses, which is the next part of our conversation, he too would have had the option to go to a court and ask for that kind of relief.
Absolutely.
In exactly the same way, right?
Absolutely.
Now, I ask this question because I know that somebody's going to say to me, yeah, you see, there we go again.
Yes.
The courts are biased towards women, against men, and so forth. So the principle would be true in all instances.
Absolutely, because we have the Bill of Rights that tells us that we cannot discriminate on the basis of gender. However, it is identified in this judgment and generally that gender and marital status are very often aspects where there is discrimination. And very often women are the
power relations are not equal.
The power relations aren't equal.
I think we cannot lose sight of that reality.
Mm-mm.
The power relations are not equal. Historically, the power relations are not equal. And for a long time, we're going to find that the power relations are not. I'm simply saying that in principle, though, that that relief is available to everybody and not just for women, right?
I think that's an important distinction to make, because I understand the criticism that we are often faced with when we have these discussions, that we always talk about women in these positions. In this particular case, the applicant is the woman.
Right.
But if it is that the applicant in the same circumstances was a man who in the course of the relationship parties had negotiated that he was going to stop working. He'd been out of the workplace for 9 years. He'd raised three children. He contributed to the growth of his girlfriend's life, enabled her to go to work, enabled her to bring home her clients and her business partners in order to be able to support her to grow her wealth. And if he was then at risk as a result of that relationship breaking down, he could approach the court. On the basis of this judgment, however, there is going to be need to be further development, or there's either going to be legislation that's going to need to be drafted, and that is very much being debated at the moment, or this particular case is going to need to be scrutinized by the Constitutional Court, and they are going to have to give their view. Because as things stand, this matter says that, in this case, the former girlfriend could not claim interim maintenance whilst the question of whether or not she was entitled to be maintained after the end of the relationship, there's a trial aspect to it. There's a question of whether or not this relationship did actually exist. That needs to be determined by a trial court. The court said, in the meantime, whilst that matter is being decided upon and made final, they are not prepared to grant her interim relief.
So they first have to have some sort of legal basis upon which they can then say she is entitled to some sort of relief. Mm. Otherwise, it's speculative. Is that what I'm understanding? That this relationship could have been a figment of somebody's imagination? Is that what they suggest?
Maybe they could have been friends, as an example. You know, that's not what is alleged in these papers. But by way of example, two people who live together as friends, for example, even if they have a reciprocal duty of maintenance to one another, they're not entitled to the relief, because there needs to be a familial aspect to this for there to be this discussion about maintenance.
Because that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, you have to look like a family.
So if I have a friend, there's no romantic connection, but there was some sort of maintenance, some sort of responsibility to each other that could be quantified, if we've got clever accountants that can actually work it out for us. Are you saying to me the friend can't go and ask for reciprocal maintenance?
Not in terms of the common law, and not in terms of this particular case, and there's no legislation that supports that. Again, could an applicant go to court and argue the reciprocity and that the law should be developed like this? Quite possibly. I think very often, unfortunately, the barriers to entry are financial. And when there are maintenance matters involved, very often the ability of a party to come to the court and seek relief, especially a high court application, it's costly.
I want to invite calls, by the way. 011-883-0702 is the number to dial. 021-446-056. This is intriguing stuff. Really, really intriguing stuff. Talk to me about this idea of some sort of familial connection. I mean, these people weren't necessarily married in the traditional sense. Where is the familial aspect that would give the court the platform upon which they could then say that there needs to be a reciprocal sort of maintenance deal happening there?
I think, bearing in mind that in this particular application, the applicant was unsuccessful, some of the facts that are alleged are that they were in this 9-year relationship. They'd born three children together.
Ah, okay.
She was wholly dependent on him.
Okay.
He maintained her lifestyle. They'd had a wedding ceremony, in inverted commas, what purported to be a wedding ceremony, though they'd never signed a marriage register. And they referred to each other as husband and wife to their friends and family. And they say,
I'm getting some easy Mohale vibes right now there, right there. Eh? Are you getting the same vibes there? Somizi, Mohale vibes. They were married, but not married. All right. Sorry, Claire.
I mean, that's a really interesting question about the, you know, the legal processes about that. I think that's something that we could talk about.
Yes.
All right. On another occasion.
I want to invite your calls. If you are as intrigued about this case as I am, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567, you'll see that my questioning to Claire have been around the right of any of the parties in that relationship to go to court. Let's go now into what happened in court, right? The applicant didn't succeed.
No.
And you're saying to me that the applicant didn't succeed because the courts haven't established a basis upon which they can then say there needs to be reciprocal payment of maintenance. Mm. Because we don't know what this thing was. Was it a marriage? Was it a friendship? Was it an entanglement? Whatever we want to call it, what was this thing?
Mm.
On the basis of that, the court will then be able to make a judgment. Why is that important? That basis, that platform?
Because that is the first step in the inquiry as to whether or not there is an entitlement to that obligation that person then has to pay.
Traditionally, we know that the only thing that we had in the past was marriage, right?
And before the Maintenance of Surviving Spouses Act, there was nothing. So legislation was introduced to create a remedy for spouses where there was previously none. And so this is interesting.
But if there were spouses, then marriage would have been that platform.
But that is because of the Maintenance of Surviving Spouses Act, that there is now a legal framework in terms of which a husband or wife, as the case may be, can come to court and say, please help me.
Okay. So in the same way, we could then create a new law that gives us a new platform upon which we can then say we can claim for reciprocal maintenance.
And one of the criticisms of the majority judgment in this particular case is that there is... The South African Human the Law Reform Commission is in the process of investigating a single marriage bill where there will be one piece of legislation instead of the multiple sets of legislation that covers all romantic relationships, what we understand to be civil marriages, customary marriages, civil unions, Muslim marriages, Hindu marriages, Jewish marriages, and these romantic relationships or permanent life partnerships. There is an inquiry or an investigation as to whether or not it's necessary to have all of these pieces of legislation existing concurrently with one another, and that we need to fill in gaps with different legislation, or whether there should be one solid piece of legislation that has all of these component parts that are dealt with. Because there are some discrepancies between, some of the proposed legislation and some of the existing legislation. And in certain instances, the court has been called upon to read into the legislation to include the word people in a permanent life partnership, for example. And that's taken place in instances like when people have died or there've been road accident fund claims for dependent claims. So the courts have started to develop this law. The question is it going to be the legislature that drafts new legislation, or is it the courts, the constitutional court? Because I think that this matter is going to go on appeal.
We've had conversations, Claire, about the concept of a common law marriage. And I think I seem to remember you suggesting that there is no such thing really, mm-mm, right? Are we moving into that territory now, given this investigation that you're talking about that the courts are doing, that perhaps there may, in the very near future, be, in one version or the other, a common law marriage thing?
I think the only distinction will be that
it's not a marriage, right?
I actually don't think it'll be referred to as a common law. Whatever, a common law marriage, a common law partnership.
Yeah.
I think it's the common law aspect that's actually going to fall away if legislation is drafted. Maybe in the legislation it'll be called romantic relationship or long-term life partnership or serious relationship or whatever. Whatever words that the legislation it brings in, I think there's a likelihood that that is then going to create.
In which case, then the court, the three court the judges, what do you call it, the full bench, would then have that basis that they are still investigating at the moment to make a final judgment on this particular case that you're talking to me about now. My understanding is that this case is still pending. She has not been successful pending a decision to be made about whether this relationship warrants some sort of reciprocal maintenance. So the jury is out, as it were. It's not that you can't or that she can't get reciprocal maintenance. It's just that there is a question that the courts still need answered in order for them to make a definitive decision about that question.
So what I can liken this case to is a Rule 43 application. What a Rule 43 application does is that it creates interim relief whilst the divorce trial is being finalized.
Yeah.
So it's an application process that sits in the gap between the end of the relationship and the end of the divorce trial. There's an action proceeding that exists next to this one. But what the applicant went to court to do was to say, whilst the trial is being finalized into the complexities of what our relationship was, please grant me interim relief. Please will you give me maintenance whilst this matter is being finalized. Please will you assist me to litigate by contributing to my legal costs, which is something that we can do when parties are married. As soon as we institute divorce proceedings, we can also institute a Rule 43. And that is where we ask for maintenance to be given to the husband or wife who is dependent upon their spouse whilst the divorce trial is being finalized. And it provides massive relief to a spouse that needs it.
Yeah.
Even if we look at a contribution towards legal fees, what that means is that the person who is in the financially stronger position effectively pays for their spouse to litigate against them, which I think is very often very difficult for people to get their heads around. But what the intention of that is to level the playing fields and to bring down that discrepancy where the economically less powerful person is able to litigate in the same playing field as their spouse
is. Trying to level the playing field. And it's a principle, I think, that all legislatures, all lawyers, all legal people are constantly grappling with, because sometimes it feels counterintuitive, right? But I think as a principle, it makes sense that you want people to fight any legal fight on an equal footing, and that's what legitimizes whatever decision comes out at the end of the process, I imagine.
And what the dissenting judgment says, so there are three judges again, and there's one who disagrees with the majority, who says their desired outcome or their judgment would be that the maintenance should have been paid. So she should have received maintenance. She should have received a contribution to her legal costs, not in the exact amounts that she claimed, smaller amounts.
A Rule 43 sort of application of sorts.
Exactly.
In this. All right, a number of questions coming through. And by the way, please give us your calls on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. Some questions coming through on the WhatsApp line. The number there is 072-702-1702. Good evening, Aubrey. Can we please tilt the conversation towards men who women leave? Would they be entitled to make such an application to the court? I think I did ask that question, right? But for the purposes of this show and its history, please indulge the question. We have gone to this question. Second question comes and says, evening, Aubrey and Claire, could your guest please explain how our law acknowledges live-in lovers of 3 months and more? Should one partner die, then their joint property is shared equally? If you can just help us with those two questions, please, Claire.
So to answer the first question, and I think it's important to deal with this question, because the law comes to the aid of the person who has a need. It doesn't matter about that person's gender. It doesn't matter about how that relationship in a life partnership familial sense is constituted. It might be heterosexual, it might be same-sex. It doesn't matter. If there is a need that one person has, and it has to be factually established that that person has a need, and if the other person has a means, has the means to support, and has, during the currency of that relationship, fulfilled that role, then the law can come to the person's aid who is in need. And this is what's important. The question is definitely not, if you're a man, you're outside in the cold, you are left out and you do not have remedy. If you are a man and you have a need, and the person with whom you are living, be it a man or a woman, if they have been the person who has been contributing to your maintenance, you are in a long-term life partnership that is familial in nature. If you are married, critically, if you are married, you are entitled to seek the court's assistance with regards to the life partnership. This aspect of the law is still developing. So the question is no more in women's favor than it is men's when it comes to life partnerships. But when it comes to marriage, it's a very clear answer. Whether you're a man or you're a woman, you're entitled to go to court and ask for maintenance if you have a need.
That men don't do or don't take advantage of that aspect of the law in this country.
I think very often they don't.
This is the point I'm trying to make. That we as men don't take advantage of that does not mean that relief is not available to us.
Mm.
And that may have something to do with our patriarchal history and past and so forth. Tigers don't cry or whatever the case may be, but that we don't take advantage of the existence of that principle does not mean that the principle does not exist.
Yes, exactly that.
Right. Secondly, evening, Aubrey and Claire, could your guest please explain how our law acknowledges live-in lovers? That's that whole common law mythical story that we've talked about in the past. Mm. But I think, again, it's an important question, because there is a belief out there that if you live with somebody for 3 months, then immediately that makes that person a common law husband or wife.
Yeah. I must say, I haven't heard 3 months. I've heard a year before. Three months feels like a very short period of time.
I think the 3 months comes from the whole issue of contracted workers.
I see.
You know the story about the contracted workers, that if somebody has been working for a company as a contracted worker, they are entitled to be made permanent.
Maybe.
It's that kind of mentality. But help me with this, yeah?
No. So there's no entitlement to one's property. Property ownership is what property ownership is. If I have a property that's I'm talking about a house now. If I have a house that's registered in my name or land that's registered in my name, and I have a partner that lives with me in that house, I have a real right to that house, and they don't have a right to claim any ownership in that property. Might they have the right to come to court and say, if I was to be evicted, I'm going to be out on the street and I've got nowhere else to go, and I'm going to be destitute, or I'm going to be living in a shelter? That falls within the realm of the discussion that we're having now. And that's the important discussion that I think is very often easier to sort of find the answer in divorce law, because there are property aspects that are variable. Remember, we've spoken about, can you change from in community of property to out of community of property?
Yeah.
There are no similar concepts in romantic relationships, but that governs, is it my house or is it your house? Is it my car? Is it your car? Is it my bank account? Is it your bank account? The question of maintenance, though, is based on this means and needs discussion, or the analysis, if I can say that. And if it is that the person is wholly reliant on that person, it's not they guarantee that just because the relationship has been a short one doesn't mean that there isn't going to need to be some aid that is given to the person who has been living in that house with someone.
Jane is in Soweto. Good evening to you, Jane.
Hi, Aubrey. How are you?
Very good, thank you, Jane. What's your question for Claire?
My question, Aubrey, is I've been in the maintenance since 1999. So the father passed away last year before last. So in 2016, the child was given 300,000 maintenance and order for the future maintenance. Now the father passed away, but he was getting 2,000 every month. But the money is in the master of the court. Mm. Now my problem is he passed away. The child is still at school, Aubrey, and I'm not working.
Yeah.
I'm 63 years of age. Now, I'm always confused for year before last year and this year. I think it's going to be 30,000 now because it was 20,000 last year that I was owing at school. I can't afford to pay it, but the money is there.
Yeah.
They don't want to give us that money. I don't want it for myself. Yeah. I want it for the child. I don't know what can I do about the doctor. If the lady can help me, please.
Claire?
Great question. The question pertains to money that is held by the Guardians Fund. The Guardians Fund is a fund that is administered by the Master of the High Court, and it holds money on behalf of minors, unidentified heirs, and adults who are unable to manage their own affairs where there is an inheritance received. By that child, in this case, the child is entitled to an inheritance, but they are under the age of 18, and so they are then unable to manage that money themselves, and so it's looked after by the Guardians Fund until such time as they turn 18. It's really, really important for people who are over the age of 18 or people who are looking after children who are over the age of 18 to assist that child to go to the Guardians Fund and to access that money. It's a criminal offence for anybody to go through the register and to contact people and to say, do you know that there's money in the Guardians Fund for you? If you pay me this, I will help you. It's a criminal offence. And so there's lots of money that is sitting in the Guardians Fund that goes unclaimed. And so it's really important for people to know that if it is that they think that they would have been entitled to money from a relative, an inheritance from a relative, and they've now turned 18, that they should approach the Guardians Fund and they should say, is there anything available for me? This is my ID number. And the Guardians Fund will be able to tell them whether or not there's any money due to them. Can be a huge relief for a family, even after that child turns 18, for them to get that money.
So what does Jane do?
In the case of a child that is under the age of 18, there need to be annual claims made to the Guardians Fund, and very often social workers will assist. So social workers that are operating within a community can be approached, and they can be asked to draw up a budget that person needs in order to know how much money that child's going to need for the year ahead and to claim that money from the Guardians Fund. And there are drawdowns on an annual basis also to provide relief to the person who is the caregiver of that child for the year ahead for that child.
Wow. So Khashev on Twitter says, so basically the law is designed so we can hire lawyers to argue the very thing that they study to argue. If the law was done without the loopholes purposely embedded, then we wouldn't need lawyers. Layman's terms, of course. I soon shall be introducing Lawyer GPT to y'all, says
Khashev. Fair point.
Third question on WhatsApp. This person says, hi, Aubrey. What about the case where a father of a child passed on and there was a future maintenance order was issued by maintenance court in 2016? I think it's very, very close to Jane's question.
Yes, close to the last question.
Yeah.
What is important is that if there is a maintenance order that exists, even if there's no maintenance order, what is important that if the person who is responsible for the paying of maintenance to a child dies, that the executor or administrator of that estate needs to be notified of the child's need or of the spouse's need, for that matter of fact. But in this case, specifically, we're being asked about children. So the executor or the administrator must be told there is a child that is in need of maintenance. there must be a calculation done as to how much money that the child is going to need until that child is no longer dependent. So it might be until the child turns 18. It might be the child until the child is done with their tertiary education. And that amount of money, a lump sum amount of money, is then earmarked out of the estate and is either paid into the guardian's fund or is paid into a trust, depending on the structures that have been set up by the deceased. And again, that money is then used for that child's maintenance, or at the end of the day, if there's a lump sum that remains, it can be paid to the child after that child turns a certain age, for example, 18, in order to pay for things like university education.
You and I need to have a conversation about this. What did you call this place at the Masters?
The Guardian's Fund.
The Guardian's Fund. Mm. We need to have a conversation about this.
Yeah.
We need to have a conversation about this. So you're saying to me that if you believe that you have some inheritance out there, so that you don't have to be scammed by anybody. Because we get those scams all the time. People's writing you something on your email or on Twitter or whatever the case may be, saying that a great-grandfather of yours left you 15 billion trillion rands. That is an offense in this country. It's not supposed to be done.
So those WhatsApps or messages or emails that people get are definitely scams.
Sure.
If you have any question about whether it's a scam or not, I would go to the magistrate's court and I would say, is this a scam? And you might find an attorney there, or you might find one of the court clerks there in the estate section who will guide you one way or another. What you will not, you won't get a notification from the Guardian's Fund. There are billions of rands that are unclaimed in the Guardian's Fund for precisely this reason, because nobody is going to contact you and say, hey, do you know that there's money for you in the Guardian's Fund?
You shouldn't say that too loud, hey, because there's people that are listening right now that might hear you. But what I do want to say is, if you think that you're entitled to some inheritance, it would do you good to go to the Guardian's Fund, administered by
the Master of the High Court.
Go with your ID and say, this is who I am. I think I might have some inheritance. Are they legally entitled to tell you whether you've got
some? They must tell you.
Okay.
They must tell you. They must say, yes, you have money, or no, sorry, you don't. And if the answer is yes, then you will be paid.
Yeah.
And it can provide.
I think we've just opened a door here for some scammers. Hey? Kate Thompson, thank you so much. How do we get in touch with you if we want to give you a call?
You can give me a call on 011-010-0400 or visit our website, www.witsinc.co.za.
Claire Thompson, and of course, always informative, specialist family law practitioner and head of family law department at Wits Incorporated.